The reading is taken from Acts chapter 2, verse 42 to 47, the fellowship of the believers. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold their property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. This is the word of God.
Brilliant job, brilliant job. I prepared the talk on Acts chapter 16. And I'm doing it anyway. Let's get a bit organised here. Good morning. Hi. So I can make any of this happen. Brilliant. As we ponder what's involved in worship together, let's check that we're beginning from good Hebrew foundations. For much of the century before Jesus, political power in Judah was fiercely contested, even lapsing at times into actual civil war. This is the Roman general Pompey. For those that have noticed, there's a bit of a quiff thing going on. Do you see that? He was known, apparently, for that quiff at the beginning. That's at the limit, by the way, of my knowledge of hairstyles, and that's not going to surprise you. The Roman general Pompey, it was a big deal, despite the quiff. The Roman general Pompey, after fighting extremely hard to secure Rome's eastern border, came finally to Jerusalem to knock the local heads together there. A process which after several more years would see Herod installed as Rome's client king in Judah. After Pompey had put down all resistance in Jerusalem, including a last stand at the Temple Mount, he took the opportunity to see something of this strange Hebrew religion for himself and entered the Holy of Holies, unaware of the offense this would cause and apparently sorry afterwards for it. As he looked around this most sacred space, he was puzzled to see no image of the deity. And in that moment, had he the capacity to grasp it, he'd encountered the very heart of Jewish identity, because the focus of Hebrew worship was not a local god, presiding in that place like a mafia boss, nor just some godly being, one among others, nor even the top god. But rather the focus of Hebrew worship was the creator of all, beside whom all other proposed divinities were empty follies. The creator, who had taken hold of the Hebrews, the descendants of Abraham, and would, through relationship with them, reveal himself to all. That relationship is called the covenant, and we'll think more on that in a second, but first just a quick bit of fun. What's the earliest TV comedy that you can remember? One that you liked. What's the earliest TV comedy that you can remember? Got it? Now, when I say go, just a second, you can make a nuisance of yourself by sharing that information with someone sitting near you. And then part two, guess together from the image about to come up what my earliest memory is of comedy. So share now. Okay, I'll take anyone calling out a guess. Go on louder. Yeah, brilliant. The 930 group, you know, congregation, you know, are very old. And I thought, but not as old as me. And they didn't get this. I don't know quite what it was. I don't know what they were doing in the 1970s. But the Monty Python gang were overbright young males with a creative relish for making ridiculous any authority that had become pompous or just silly, including the church. In the cartoon sequence, opening the program each week, a giant foot, the one you saw, a giant foot squished an unsuspecting individual. Now, we don't really think God has feet that can squish people, and sensible Hebrews didn't think that either. So what is the Bible doing when it refers to God's anatomy? In Psalm 18, for example, he heard my voice, my cry came before him into his ears. Smoke rose from his nostrils, consuming fire came from his mouth. He parted the heavens and came down. Dark clouds were under his feet. Aha! I think I see where Monty Python slipped up. Schoolboy error. They hadn't noticed that this was a poetic image, a mind picture of God's irresistible sovereign power, rather than a recorded sighting of anatomy. Glad we cleared that up. So to loop back and wrap up the Pompey reference, the thing is that across the Roman world, temples did have statues of the worshipped deity, hence Pompey's puzzle. But the Jews did not. It was forbidden, and for this beautiful reason. Yahweh, the God of the covenant, had ordained that the way divinity would be revealed in the world was through relationship. His covenant relationship with Israel. And just to take a quick aside, John Walton I find hugely helpful. And if you have 7 minutes to spare, he beautifully talks about covenant. That's on YouTube, as you can see. And two quick things about the covenant. So we can see it's a great place. The covenant is a great place to anchor our thoughts about worship. And the two things are temple and Torah, and they go together and only make sense together. I don't know what the picture should be, but for me it was like a coin. And that you could have a coin made counterfeit, and you wouldn't realize until you saw that what was on the other side didn't match what was on the side that you first looked at, if you see what I mean. It would look perfectly good, and then you saw the other side actually wasn't the right match. Temple and Torah, and I'll explain in a second, for me, to be authentic, are like a coin with two sides, and it takes both of them. The Jewish law isn't a scheme for building up credit with God. Remember the purpose of the covenant relationship. It's God's chosen way to reveal himself in creation, with human image bearers central to the plan. Torah's job is to shape the community life of God's people. Torah's job is to shape the community life of God's people so that they are faithful image bearers. And God is there in the center, celebrating that life with them. The temple gives that celebrating and sharing its focal point. The temple worship powers the community life, and the fruits of that life are celebrated back in the temple. And God is with God's people, both in the empowering and in the celebrating. And here's what's both tragic and gracious at the same time. When this goes well, there's blessing, of course there is. But when this goes badly, God is still revealing himself to creation. For God's people Israel, there will be exile. The prophets, as champions of the covenant, had warned them. There would be exile, but there would be return as well when the time was right. And yet the propensity to do it all again is not removed. The roots lie somewhere deep in contested ground. So there will be another champion and a real battle. And still all along, it's about temple and Torah. Torah's job is to shape the community life of God's people so that they are faithful image bearers. The temple provides the focus and the celebration space. God present with his people. And the battleground has a name, Gethsemane and Golgotha or Calvary. So that my exile and alienation, your exile and alienation, all creation's exile and alienation will in that place be born, absorbed, and cancelled, held in the bond between the Father and the Son. The cross's anguish and agony is borne by the Father too. And this was done publicly and was recorded so that everyone could know it had been done. And the champion's vindication, Easter morning. And the champion's prize, us together. Jesus becomes the temple, the focus and the celebration space for God dwelling in the midst of his people. And the Spirit, the communicating, empowering Spirit from the Father and the Son, will be Torah, shaping the community life of God's people so that they can be faithful image bearers. This is the grounding of our worship together. And to return to that reading from Acts, where Luke shows us the church getting started in all this. And I have a question. And my question is this: do you find it encouraging or discouraging? I mean, surely it's a little bit idealized. It's got to be okay to say perhaps that was then and this is now. Because from time to time, folks somewhere do try the everything in common way of doing church. And reports are, it's not that easy. So I'm going to take a quick look at two other New Testament churches, first in Philippi and then in Corinth. How do they get on with worship together? Paula Gooder is a New Testament scholar who from time to time does theology through a narrative, rather like the Old Testament does in many places. Because sometimes narrative does more to help us see, understand, and feel than theological definitions alone manage. Narrative can have a power to bring transformation. Lydia's the businesswoman whose generosity and good practical organizing sense gave Paul his base when he first arrived in Philippi. Paula Gooder uses her scholarship to imagine the story of this new church, using Lydia as a key character. It's just a story to help us see, understand, and feel, but it's consistent with the evidence in Acts. Also consistent with the evidence in Paul's letter to that church. His letters to them long after he's been forced to move on through. Though all the time, treasuring the ongoing connection. It's very likely he's been supported financially in all sorts of other ways. Paul treasuring the ongoing connection with them very dearly. Paul knows how much the church worked with him to grow their faith and to reach others, and how they continued to grow after he'd been forced out by the city authorities. But now he hears that there's been some cause of friction. Been some friction between folk, and it's developed into a fixed standoff between them and their leaders. And probably the others have had to take sides, and the hurts have deepened. There's some great names coming up. Here we go. I struggle with all the pronunciation of names. I have to say that, and whether you can empathize with me here. I think Euodia, and I think Syntyche. I'm not sure I've done very well, but you can see which bit I'm probably trying to read, which may not be the names that are so common now for christenings, for any families looking for names. You perhaps choose something else. But these two ladies have been powerhouses and should still be powerhouses. But there's been some kind of falling out. We don't know quite what it was over, but we get how that happens. And they've stayed at a distance from one another. And Paul loves this church. He's not just doing his job, he's received love, and he has love only for them. Only has love for them. Paul's loving, firm, and direct. His words are careful. His scope is wide. This is for all of them. Let the same mind be in you, he says, that was in Jesus, who emptied himself and took the form of a slave. Now, Paul Aguda says, if you're someone with status in the city, you'll hear Paul saying one thing. But imagine you're there listening and you're a domestic slave, permitted to be briefly absent from work and mindful that you mustn't stay too long. How might you feel as you hear Paul point out that Jesus took the form of a slave, your identity in this community? How does it shape our worship together to remember that Jesus, the one we worship, was servant by choice, for the sake of what that would make possible, for the sake of those who would know themselves reached? And of course, Paul goes on, rejoice. Rejoice because the Lord's near. Rejoice because the Lord's near, and knowing that you can be gentle. Rejoice because the Lord's near, and knowing that you can be gentle and not mind who sees it. For the church in Philippi, their worship together in unity, would be exactly as strong as their humility. Their unity would be as strong as their humility. And in their unity of purpose, they would know themselves to be co-workers together in the gospel. If I can add something personal here, something I remember from the first months after I became a Christian, newly arrived at uni. There were only 10 or 11 students in the College Christian Union, but on a Tuesday evening, folk who could get away from their essays met in the chapel for communion together. There were no musical instruments, so singing could be very exposing for someone without a confident voice. But there was a different spirit there, a sense between us that in our worship, everyone's voice mattered. Aided by the group leader's encouragement of remember who you're singing to. Let's move along now and look in on Corinth. There's lots of topics addressed in Paul's letters, and Paul anchors many of them back in temple and Torah. Jesus, the new temple, and the communicating, empowering spirit being Torah, shaping the community life of God's people so that they can be faithful image bearers. For us this morning, I picked just one of Paul's topics, food. Food together or not. Connected with worship together or not. But first, a short story. The father of a friend of mine wrote a little book for his family before he died. In it, he reminded them of some of the things God had done for them as a family, reminded them of their experiences living life with God. The first story was of his parents, my friend's grandparents, who as a young couple were missionaries in Syria at the time of the First World War. In any conflict, prisoners are a nuisance. They need guarding, they consume supplies, and they wear the uniform of the soldiers who killed those you cared about. Prisoners do not tend to get treated well. One day, my friend's grandmother saw about 100 prisoners of war, Turks, being marched through the camp and brought to a halt near her tent. The men were exhausted, some without boots, all of them wretchedly hungry. She knew they must be fed and quickly, but had very little to offer. So she took what she had, not much more than flour, oil, and water, and mixed and cooked and prayed. And all the men were fed. It's not magic, there's nothing to explain, it's just life with God. But imagine how she felt as she continued the day in, day out service with her husband as missionaries in that place. Now, still with food and back to Corinth, the church in Corinth in many ways reflected the city. There's new money, sharp wits, and perhaps it's a bit flashy. And like anywhere, there's less prosperous folk too, probably a lot of them. For the well-off, celebrating the Lord's Supper seems to have involved pre-parties and after-parties. Invitation only, of course. The uninvited wouldn't have the time anyway. Tellings off are never fun, but both in Philippi and in Corinth, Paul is drawing folk back to the real center of authentic worship together. The surrendering of status, like Jesus, and the practice of sharing for the inclusion of others, just as the Spirit is shared with us. And if the bar is too high and the ask too great, then I need to remember that this worship together, in Acts, for example, wasn't just God's thinking, but God's doing. That doesn't make it easy, but it does make it trustworthy. To worship together will take trust, trusting God's Spirit to make worship together real. The Bible's full of messages to help us grow that trust, lots and lots of them, and many of you know these better than I do. We're going to try just four. And I come to the Bible, so it's about growing trust. It's about using the Bible to grow trust. And I come to the Bible and I ask, what can God be trusted for? And I read in Isaiah, though the mountains be shaken and the hills be removed, yet, says God, yet my unfailing love for you will not be shaken, nor my covenant of peace be removed, says the Lord who has compassion on you. What can God be trusted for? And a letter from James, the leader of the church in Jerusalem. If any of you lacks wisdom, now it's not easy, the worship together, it's not something we can do. It's something that we cooperate, we're co-workers in it. It's not going to be easy, it's going to take a lot of wisdom. And what does James say? If any of you lacks wisdom, my hand's up. If any of you lacks wisdom, you should ask God who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it'll be given to you. And the letter to the Hebrews, let us hold unswervingly. This is going to take persistence. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful. It's God's work. And the fourth one, Paul's writing to the church in Rome, imagining himself being there, a very large amount of material for us to digest, but it has this blessing in it. What can God be trusted for? And Paul blesses them with, may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. So back once more to our main reading from Acts. I notice how frequently it mentions everyone, together. And at the end, the Lord adding to their number, and the Lord doing all of the above as well. So who's doing it? The Lord's doing it. So to conclude now this morning, I wonder if I could imagine a picture of this worship together here in our own time. And perhaps the following may be helpful. The scene is a wide, crowded marketplace full of noisy buying and selling, haggling and complaining. But some of the crowd seem to be dancing together, teaching each other the moves. Some folk are watching, though most haven't noticed. And some of those watching begin to join in. But only the dancers hear the music, while the buying and selling, haggling and complaining, hear only their own noise, for now. Let's trust the one who calls us to worship together. Thank you.